word of mouth is the most effective form of marketing you will ever get. If somebody recommends a product to you that you know and trust, you will then buy that product. And that is what really started our brand to roll.
It takes courage and belief in yourself and your business idea to take the step to set up your own business. In the early stages, entrepreneurship can be a lonely road, even through those milestone moments. Deciding to commit to the idea you've been mulling over, learning, growing, and developing your skills, building a team to help you along the way, preparing to launch into new markets. Enterprise Ireland is there for all of those startup moments. From providing advice and guidance to new founders through our startup network, to pre-seed funding and early investment, we're here to help bring your ambition to fruition. To find out how Enterprise Ireland can help you on your startup journey, visit enterprise-ireland.com. Before we dive into today's episode, I want to share a game changer for your business, Azure Communications. When it comes to print and marketing solutions, these folks, led by CEO Jenny Johnston, are the real deal. Whether you need an eye-catching brochure, sleek business cards, or a full-blown digital campaign, Azure Communications has you covered. They're not just about high-quality prints or digital campaigns, they're also about delivering great results. And here's the best part. Just for listeners of The Entrepreneur Experiment, you can get 20% off your first order. Just give them a call or go online and use the code FOX20. With personalized service and fast turnaround times, Azure Communications will help you make the impact your business deserves. Trust me, when it comes to making your brand stand out, Azure Communications is the provider of choice. Check them out at azurecom.ie. Use code FOX20 and elevate your marketing game today. Nostra, an Irish IT company, offers world-class managed IT services, cloud solutions, IT support, and more, all tailored to meet your business needs. Whether you're streamlining operations or boosting productivity, their expert team is ready to help. Visit nostra.ie or email info@nostra.ie to see how they can solve your IT challenges today.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome to the Entrepreneur Experiment Live. Thanks to the local enterprise offices here in the Mason. We've got two very esteemed guests joining me today. We have Tom, Kyo's Farm, and Noreen from Advanced Cosmetics. So please give them a round of applause.
Thank you very much.
Tom, we'll start with you. What is Kyo's Farm?
What is Kyo's Farm? Kyo's Farm is this wonderful Disneyland-like place on the beautiful green fields of Ireland, just in North County Dublin. I suppose it's a farm. We've been there as a family for about 200 years. The earliest document I found when I started doing a bit of digging was a tithes or a land tax paid to the local church back in 1833 by a Thomas and Catherine Kyo, same name as myself, on the family farm where it is today. So we've been there a while, and market gardening was our thing. So if you could grow it in the Irish climate, we've tried to grow it. We've tried to sell it in the Dublin markets and make some money from it. And that's basically what my family have done for multiple generations. And obviously today, people know us for more than just fresh produce. They know us for a snack food brand as well, which is sold in Ireland, but also in 20 countries around the world.
What was the change? Because to go from market gardening to a brand that's global, I think that's the secret sauce everyone's trying to do. Yeah. What prompted that change?
Necessity. Yeah, necessity prompted that. So I suppose if you look at what has happened in that whole fresh produce market gardening area in Ireland since I kind of came into the business, which was around the year 2000, is that basically one of the key drivers was the corner shops have disappeared. Yeah, so we used to have all the corner shops around Ireland, you know, under family names, family run, etc. They've all disappeared and they've been replaced by, you know, Spars, Centras, Mace, Lombus. These are all symbol groups that in actual fact have one single sourcing office behind them. So what happened there was that as the corner shops started to migrate to the symbol groups, the buying went from the local markets to a central office with one central distribution center. So instead of dealing with maybe 20 wholesalers in a market, which is my father and my grandfather used to do on a, you know, 4 o'clock on a Tuesday morning, we all of a sudden we had one person, and that one person was making purchasing decisions for all those stores, which forced us to obviously rethink our approach. And I suppose when I came into the business, I could see that we had amazing quality. There was a fantastic culture in the business for quality, which my family had built up for generations. You know, really, really high quality produce, and we were known for that. But the problem was that we had no connection with the end consumer because it wasn't branded. And that was probably one of the first things that I did when I came into the business, was establish that brand and make that connection, which is probably the first step along the journey of where we've got to today. Mm.
Brilliant. Thanks for the overview. Nori, Avance Cosmetics, what is it?
Avance Cosmetics is an end-to-end contract manufacturer for cosmetic products. So what it is in a nutshell really is we take an idea or a concept, we develop it into a product, we test it, and we produce it, manufacture it, fill it, label it, code it, pack it and palletize it, and ship it worldwide.
Okay, nice and brief succinct.
Yeah.
Tell me a bit more though. When you say, like, are we seeing Avance Cosmetics products on the shelf under your own brand, or is it under other people's brands, or how does it work?
No, so we work for 37 different brands at the moment. And what we do is we take a concept or initial idea, we work with the brand to develop a product. Once the product is developed, then it goes through all of the testing process, and we will hand it over to the brand then to start doing their branding on it and think up USPs on it, and we manufacture it then for them. So what you see is the idea thought through, and the brand is the one that sells it on the market.
Okay, so the brand can come to you and go, we need a new type of, like, what would be a big product? You don't have to name the brand, but what kind of product would be big?
Yeah, so we work on anything from skincare to body care to perfumery to self-tanning products. So they could come to us and say, well, we want a self-tanning mousse. We want it to be moisturizing, hydrating, along with the self-tanning properties. And so we would go into the lab and we would come up with unique selling points to put different materials that are innovative into the product so that they can sell in an increasingly competitive market. And once we develop it, then we can bring it into full production.
Okay, that's really interesting. I think a lot of people wouldn't know that, in terms of they just think the brand makes the product and that's it. You know, they come up with this great idea, but it's actually you behind the scenes. How did you get into that?
So when I was in college, I studied chemistry. And as part of that course, I did a work placement module. And like everyone, when you do chemistry, you probably think you want to get into big pharma company and change the world, and I thought the same. And I did an interview with a big biopharma company and didn't get it, and I was a bit disappointed at the time. But then my second interview was with a cosmetic company based in Mayo as well, and at the time it was one of the largest manufacturing companies in Ireland. And did the interview, loved it, and got taken on for 6 months on the work placement, and then eventually got kept on for the summer. And then when I finished my fourth year of college, I got a phone call to come on board for a full-time position in that manufacturing company because the chemist was leaving. So I worked for that company for over 6 years under John O'Sullivan, who sort of became a mentor to me, and he allowed me to grow within the industry. And he allowed me to take off the R&D side of the business. And not alone that, I got to work in quality control, I got to work in manufacturing, I got to work in on the filling lines, in every part of it, working with sales teams and working with, I suppose, every aspect of the company. And I was allowed to do that, which wouldn't be seen in a big company, you know. So I got a great start in it. And then John, in 2016, 2017, John decided he was going to retire. So I worked there for probably another year, and then I decided I can probably do this for myself. So I leave. Before I left, I didn't really know how to start the business. I was kind of thinking, oh God, how will I start this business? And I enrolled in a Start Your Own Business course with the local enterprise office. And that kickstarted the whole process of building a business plan and structuring the business model so that it became, I suppose, a viable business to go to banks for funding and the local enterprise office to grant aid me as well. So that's how it all started. And I started with the lab, and we built a brand new lab in 2019 in Ballina. And then we built up a portfolio of clients, I'd say about 20 clients at the time, and we developed the products. And at the time, we tech transferred them into different manufacturing facilities all over the world. So there'd be some in Ireland, some in the UK.
But what does that mean? Is it you would contract people to make them for you, was it?
So the brand, what we did was we worked for the brand. And the brand then decided where they would go to manufacture based on the best customer service, the best price they were getting. And we would help them tech transfer it in. So when, really what I was doing was I was going into manufacturing sites and designing methods of manufacture for the manufacturing companies on the products that we developed. And we were going to the UK, France, Germany, Poland. And after a while, I kind of just thought, we're doing all the work here, developing these amazing, innovative products, and we're giving them away to different contract manufacturers. So I thought, again, I'll do this myself. And in 2021, I started the business plan for that. And on November 22nd, 2022, we started producing for one of our biggest clients.
That's a rapid turnaround, 2019. That's amazing. Yeah. Tom, you mentioned something very interesting there, and I want to go back and pick it apart, because I think for a lot of business owners in the audience, they'll kind of want to understand that more. You talked about the branding. You're like, I knew I had to introduce branding. So talk me through that. Like, what was your thought process behind, okay, you've seen the big shift here. You've seen that they're going to one single source. What was your thoughts behind the branding?
Well, I suppose at the end of the day, successful business gets close to the customer. Yeah. And if you can gain ownership of your point of consumption, then you're in an incredible, powerful position to negotiate along the whole supply chain. So when I joined the family business, which is a very small family farm back then, I could see that we had a point of difference around quality. We really did have a point of difference around quality. And I suppose the inner marketeer in me saw that we had a point of difference with our story, in that it was a true story. And when we went to talk to branding experts about, you know, how we were going to brand our business, and Borbia were extremely helpful in that process, the people who won that tender were the only people that came into us and said, you guys are living a story. All we need to do is tell your story, because it will resonate with the consumer. And that was in 2006. And back then, that was groundbreaking. It sounds so simple today, but back then, like, I nearly fell off my chair. I was like, wow. Because there was nobody ever marketed the producer of a product. If you walk into a supermarket today, you will see posters on the walls of, you know, farmers and heads of cabbage and, you know, driving a tractor. And, you know, they're all trying to talk about the fact that they support farmers and there's provenance behind our products. We were the first to do that. And the difference is that we were farmers doing that. We were marketing ourselves to the customer, which really, really resonated. I remember we did a photo shoot on the farm, and we'd never done anything like that. And there's a picture today that is on the back of every bag of crisps. It's like myself, my dad, brother, cousin, uncle. And that picture must have been printed 400 or 500 million times since. And that picture was completely by chance. Completely by chance. We happened to be all kind of in the vicinity of a field where my uncle was driving a tractor at the time. And we said, right, we'll all go to see. Can everybody get to this field? That was 2006. I don't think we've all been in a field together since. And there happened to be a fence in the middle of the field of potatoes. And we all just got up on the fence and put our shoulder on the fence. The photograph, the photographer took a photograph, and that photograph became that photograph that's on the back of every single bag. But as well as that, we started to feature us as a family individually on each pack. So you had like a bag of rooster was like my uncle, like a bag of Morris Piper was my father. You know, they were on the back holding the product. So with, you know, immense pride in the quality that we could deliver. But that was very fresh, very innovative at the time. And it resonated with the Irish consumer, really did.
I'm always saying this to founders, I'm like, push yourself forward. You are interesting. People might care about your product, they might not, but they care about you. They care about your story, why you started the business. And I think it resonates even more when you're the ones making it. Was that hard though? Because a lot of founders I talk to, I'm like, look, the biggest uplift for you here is to push yourself forward. And they're always pushing back on, I just don't feel comfortable. Was that hard for you putting yourself and your family forward?
Yes. And I suppose it wasn't for everybody either. You know, some people were quite comfortable, you know, doing it. Some people probably weren't. But I think what helped us was we were all very young at the time. Myself, my brother, my cousin, we were just willing to give it a go. And what helped was the reaction and the feedback, the consumer feedback. You know, it was working. And it was working with the Irish retailers. And, you know, very quickly you saw a lot of people start to copy you, you know, which is a great sign that it's really
first
working.
They laugh at you, then they copy you.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. And I think they were laughing at the start. And it also worked with the retailers. The retailers liked it. And I suppose at the time we started to do a lot of consumer events like Bloom and the Ploughing Match and, you know, the Tullamore Show, all these consumer events around Ireland. And you got to talk to the customers, you know, and they really did. It really did resonate with them. Yeah. And it grew from there.
Was it a hard switch, though, to go from kind of we're talking here with Noreen about being behind the scenes? Was it hard to go from being behind the scenes to actually then being the front facing, to actually going out, talking to customers, you know, getting their opinion, getting their feedback?
Yes, it was challenging. But I suppose we were up for the challenge. I knew that this was us making a difference, you know, and this is what was going to actually turn this business around. We didn't have the expertise at all. You know, we learned as we went. But what I found, especially in the early days, was that there was a genuineness to what we did. You know, we're not polished. We're not perfect. We make mistakes. But like, people expect that, you know, and you don't take that and own it. And over time, as you get experience and you do more and you talk to more people and you do more marketing, and it just starts to kind of turn into this flywheel, you know, and it just keeps on turning.
Mm. You mentioned it there. You went to the local enterprise office and you got your business plan. What was kind of like the tipping point for you where you're like, I'm definitely going to do this myself? Because that's the bit I'm always fascinated about with people, because it's the zero to one piece is the hardest, because we all have ideas and it's turning them from like an idea to, oh, there's the product. What was the moment for you?
I think it was when I got to the stage of the business in the former job I was in, where I was doing it all anyway. I felt I was doing it all anyway. I was in every department in the company as it was. We'll say John retired in 2016, 2017. The new owner took over in between 2017 and 2018, it was probably January. And when he took over, I was on my honeymoon. So I wasn't there for the first 2 weeks. But he interviewed everyone in the company. And when I came back then, he said, oh, I haven't interviewed you yet. Come on in and I'll interview you. And I was like, okay, it's a bit strange. But anyway, so he opened his book and on every page, he just went, I interviewed everyone and he just started going through it. He goes, Noreen, 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 Noreen. He said, how is it that you're involved in every part of this business, like as one person? And then that was kind of the clicking point with me when I went, geez, I'm doing it anyway. Why don't I just do it for myself? And probably a few weeks later, that's when I started the ball rolling. And it happened all very quickly. I think one Friday, I sat on my computer and wrote my resignation letter, and I just out the door and went. So I do that. I tend to do that anyway. I tend to make decisions very quickly. And if I make a decision, I stand by it and I go, that's it.
So 2019, like it's been a rapid rise for you. What's been kind of like the earliest challenges you faced when you started off 2019? What was kind of the biggest hurdle you had to overcome?
To be honest, and I know this mightn't sound like right, but I don't feel I had that many hurdles to overcome. I was very good at what I did and I didn't find it hard to get clients. My husband helped me in building the state-of-the-art lab that we had. He found the premises and we built it together. And, you know, I just didn't find any part of it hard because when I started drawing up the business plan, I made it very strong and I got that help in making it very strong. And one of the main things that I got from the local enterprise office was show your figures, where are your figures coming from? And I went out to the clients that I knew and I said, look, I just need letters of intent to say you're going to intend to do a certain amount of business with me over the next few years. And, you know, the AIB bank didn't blink an eye. They backed it from the very beginning. And I suppose I've been lucky like that, that I don't really see any challenges. The main challenges that have come is that I've grown my family while I'm growing my business. And that's probably the most challenging part of it. Like my youngest is only 9 months. So, yeah, so it's been challenging for the last few years. But when it comes to business, I think if you love what you do, you won't hang on to the challenges. You'll see the good parts, I suppose.
Yeah, I love that attitude. How did you find your first couple of clients? Because you kind of referenced it there. And again, for people that are in the audience who might be in the early stages, how did you find the first kind of couple?
The first few clients that I worked with? Well, I had actually worked with them for a long time prior to that. And I think I tried to structure it in a different way in that it was more, you know, brief focus. So we work off briefs on products. So we work together, either we come up with the product idea or the brand comes up with the product idea. And then at that point, we get together, we discuss it, we talk about how we're going to make it innovative, how it's going to sell on the market, come up with unique selling points for it. And it's funny, to develop a product, you really need to know who you're working with. You need to know what they like, what they dislike, especially what they dislike, I suppose, because when it comes to fragrances and things like that, it's very personal to a person and you need to build strong relationships. And I suppose securing the clients wasn't hard because I tend to build strong relationships with people that I work for because they become friends. You know, they become people that you know over the course of 8 or 9 years that you've worked very closely with. And they're all entrepreneurs. They're all people who have started their own business. And you're kind of on a level ground at that point. And they're trying to run their business. We're trying to run our business. If they're successful, I'm successful and vice versa. So it wasn't hard to build relationships with the first few brand owners.
And Tom, for you, did you just hard stop the traditional farming, as you want to call it, as you were doing the market gardening you were doing? Was it a hard stop into brand, or how did you manage that transition of essentially running two businesses simultaneously?
I was very lucky in that the years kind of preceding the brand, I had tendered for the Superquinn potato supply when I was about 23, 24, about that age, and didn't get it. And then about a year later, they gave me a little bit, like 2%. And I think within 18 months, we had about 100%. Yeah, so we were doing a really good job with Superquinn. But that was my first stepping stone from being, you know, the guy that drove the tractor and grew the potatoes to the guy that was now managing, you know, a multi-million euro account with, the most important thing, some of the best expertise in food in Ireland at the time. And I learned so much off those people. Every time I went into Superquinn, I was like a sponge. They had people that obviously trained under Fergal Quinn. And they were experts in their field. And they wanted the job done their way. And they had a certain customer that wanted the highest quality product they could get in this country. So we delivered that for them. And for me, like, I just loved the opportunity to learn from them and learn about retail, you know, learn about retail and go into every store. And I knew every single manager, you know, I knew every shop like the back of my hand. And their category was a huge success for the years preceding their eventual move into receivership. But those years were a stepping stone for me that got me to a point where I could actually brand a business, but also move on to that next stage, which was the snack foods.
Mm. And did you keep them running simultaneously, or did you move everything in then into the branded side of the business?
We kept them running simultaneously. You see, yeah. So we would have had the Kyo. This is in fresh now. So we would have the Kyo brand. We would have had the Peter Kyo and Sons brand, which was my grandfather's brand that we would have sold into the wholesale markets. We kept that as a wholesale brand, and then we had that little bit of private label with Superquin as well. And at the time, we just started to do business with BWG at the same time, who were Spar, the Spar Group. Yeah, we started to do business with them as well in Ireland. Yeah, so farm, pack house, and the whole marketing brand. Yeah, they were all running together before the eventual snack food business launched.
And how did you do that? Because a lot of entrepreneurs, we get distracted by nature. We're always chasing that new idea, the new product, and it can tend to lead to a splitting of the focus. How did you maintain standards, quality, and growth across the different areas?
Before the snack food brand, or
as you were growing into it? I think that's the bit I'm really interested in. As entrepreneurs are in the audience, they're probably like always thinking about growing their business and evolving their business.
Yeah.
So how did you keep that focus as you evolved into the new stage?
So I think that needs to change as the business changes over time and the business grows, etc. For me, I was very lucky in that I had in everything we did before snacks, I had experience in all of that. And I was good at it. Good enough that I could add value to every area as people come into the business. So people kind of learned around me. And then when the new stuff started to come in, so, you know, snacks, some completely unheard of that we had no experience with. What I found was that we really did take our time. Yeah, we took our time doing these new things and we learned a lot about them. I didn't hire in expertise. Yeah, I was at a trade show in Cologne 2 days ago and met one of my competitors. And I noticed that their whole team included people that had previously had careers in our industry in different businesses and had built up 20, 30 years of experience. I didn't do it like that at all. If somebody had 30 years experience, I didn't want them in the business. You know, we learned as we went and we learned to do it our way, which turned out to be a better way. Yeah. And has got us to where it is today. So as the business developed and as the entrepreneur's focus starts to change, eventually you get to a point where you've built enough people around you with that level of expertise in the essence of what makes your business different, that your focus can then start to move around as required.
And Noreen, kind of similar to you, you've evolved multiple times. So you started off with the lab yeah. And then you moved into production. How did you manage that switch?
It was very difficult because the lab itself is very easy run and it's very innovative and fun, and you're developing something new every single day, whether it be methods or formulas, or you know, you're coming up with different concepts for the brand, and it's just a fun business to be in. The manufacturing is different. It's more like, I always call it, it's like a monster of a business, because there's so many aspects of the business that needs to align at the same time in order for product launch to come together, we'll say. So the management of that is quite hard. I sourced all the equipment within, I'd say, 8 months from about, I think, started in November of 2021 sourcing the equipment. So as I said earlier, I was in manufacturing sites all over Europe. So we would have been in two or three in Ireland and the UK and France and Germany and Poland. So I would have had a keen insight into the different manufacturing apparatus they use, the filling lines. And as I was saying to Tom earlier on, I used to go around and take a few pictures of different things. So while usually it would be an engineer who would go out and purchase all of this equipment, I sourced it from all over Europe over the course of probably about 4 or 5 months, and then it had to be shipped to me and I had to organise that as well. So I turned into a little engineer for a few months of my life, and it was a very rewarding year, because to source all that equipment, you're talking maybe 2 million's worth of equipment from all over Europe, and to just make those decisions very rapidly and just, I suppose, just get on with it sort of attitude, which I would have about nearly everything. When it came to the first batch production, I remember going into work that morning at about 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning and being like, geez, it all landed here. It's all here and I can start. And I hopped on the forklift and lifted all the stuff into the batch and started. And when the lads came in to do the rest of the batch with me, I had nearly half it done already, because I was just so excited that I'd pulled it all together within that year. And as well as that, my biggest client, and she's still my biggest client today, and she's one of the best, I suppose, businesswomen you'll ever deal with. She put her faith in me with her business. So she was with a different contract manufacturer at the time. And she said, you build it, I'll give you my products. And I said, sound, I'll do that. So yeah, she put in a huge order for about 250,000 units, which to us was massive, like, you know. And that first day on the 22nd of November, I produced the largest batch that I'd ever produced in my career on my own site. So it was, that's when I thought, oh, this is hugely rewarding. Like, it's just, it all came together, and it came together very fast. But things tend to happen like that with me, because I just make decisions quite quickly and not
think too much about it. Can you talk to me about that? Because that's actually something that's really tough when you work for yourself, is making decisions, because there's no one to go, yeah, Noreen, that's a really good idea, let's do it. But for you, you seem to be able to move quickly. How do you avoid the decision paralysis? How do you make decisions very decisively and very quickly? Because it's a theme coming through as we chat.
I think it's just the want to succeed is greater than any sort of fear you'd ever have. I tend to not have fear about anything, like, especially in business, I wouldn't have much fear. I would just say, what's the worst that can happen? You know, and typically if you think like that, what is the worst that can happen? You know, if my business, God forbid, touch wood, ever went under in the morning, I'd get a job somewhere else. So I just think, what's the worst that could happen? Just get on with it and put the head down. And that's typically how I deal with the business. And I like having full control over the decisions. I don't have to ask anyone. You know, it's nice to be able to get advice. And my husband he's an entrepreneur as well. He runs his own business. And I would, you know, get advice from him on things. My parents run their own business. They're probably where I get all my work ethic from. And, you know, I've advisory people around me if I need them, but I like to be able to just make a decision and roll with it, I suppose. Mm.
You know? I love that you back yourself. It's also interesting that your partner and your parents are entrepreneurs. I've interviewed, I think, 260 entrepreneurs now, and nearly always it's mum, dad, uncle, aunt, cousin. It's so interesting. And I always say this in the pod, you have to see it to be it. That's why I love doing stuff like this. Like, it's so impactful to be able to go, oh, okay, I learned a lot of Noreen. I could definitely, like, follow her path. And then for you, Tom, you've grown this brand to be something that's, like, bigger than you now. It's much bigger than yourself. What's been the kind of the critical decisions you made along the way? Kind of similar to Noreen, like, she had the lab and then brought the production in-house. What's been the critical decisions you made on the way that now in hindsight you can look back and go, that was super important?
I think for us, it was that kind of almost religious attention to quality, that it was never challenged. And at times we may have been given opportunity, or there are things we could have done to reduce cost, to get business, to grow the business quicker, that I didn't do. I just maintained that upper high quality level. And we test that. Every 12 weeks, we independently go to 250 households around Ireland, and they get plain bags of crisps with their competitive set. And we get them to consume all that product. And that's all that data is then pulled together and sent back to us. So it's not good enough for us to say that we're the best. We want our consumers to tell us that we're the best. Yeah. And I'll be honest, we don't always win. But if we don't win, we do something about it. And we make sure we do. And that's the difference that keeps us up there all the time. We used to do benchmarking on the farm. So all the team would get into the canteen, and we'd have like 20 bowls of crisps all around the canteen. Everybody would score them on different levels. And after about 6 months, like I started to realize that everybody knew our crisps. So we always came first. And I said, that's not right. We can't always come first. That's not truthful. So that's why we still do it internally, but it's more of an exercise. I use it almost as a cultural exercise for people to understand what we're doing versus our competitors. But we rely on our customers to feed back to us that we maintain that position when it comes to quality. So that was key. And we exist because of that. But that quality, high quality position, we're the most expensive product on the market. Yeah. And people, they need a reason to pay that extra bit of money. And so many brands don't do that. They launch a product that looks great. You know, that'll get you one sale. You know, that product doesn't deliver, you're not getting the return sale. So maintaining that position, I think, was the most important thing I've done over the years to get the product, to get the brand to where it is today.
How have you expanded then? As you told me a little bit earlier, like, you're about to launch a new site on the farm. So how have you grown? Because like, Gyoza is everywhere now. You go into any shop, Kills is there. You go in Aer Lingus, you go abroad, Kills is there. How have you expanded the production to match that? Like, how did you manage to go up the curve without the wheels falling off?
I always get worried when people say Kills is everywhere. And I'll be honest with you, when I started off, like, I went to the bank, my first business plan, I went to the Bank of Ireland in Swords, and my business plan was to sell crisps at farmers markets around Ireland for 5 years. That was my business plan. Like, I didn't have that aspiration to be where I am today. I had to develop that organically. Yeah. And when the first key accounts started to contact us, I was like, oh, they're not getting their crisps. No way, I don't want to see my crisps there. You know, I was so protective of the brand and what we did. I was like, no, they're not getting, I don't want to see that. No, we're going to be in just the little independent stores here. But, you know, very quickly I started to realize that Ireland's a really small country, and you can't be a niche brand in Ireland. You won't survive. You will always be a mom and pop. Yeah, you'll never go beyond that. So we grew the brand really in Ireland, and I know people talk about word of mouth, you know, but word of mouth is the most effective form of marketing you will ever get. If somebody recommends a product to you that you know and trust, you will then buy that product. And that is what really started our brand to roll. We had very effective PR in the early days. I had no marketing budget. One of the first things we did was launch Ireland's first National Potato Day. Was a complete tongue-in-cheek. Ireland had no National Potato Day, and we were like, okay, let's do it. So we launched Ireland's first National Potato Day, brought to you by Kyo's. I rented out a little corner in Merrion Square, and we had potato games. We invited chip fans in. We kids. It was done in August, and it was done at a time when there's no news in Ireland. And that day cost me 24,000 euro. Again, everything was done and paid for. And it brought in 1.8 million euros worth of media coverage. And it won Consumer Campaign of the Year at the PR Awards that year. From nobody knew anything about us to being right there winning the award within the first year. So that was a great way to start the awareness around the brand. And if you think of Ireland back then, this was 2011, 2012. So Ireland was in the depths of a recession. And I remember at the time we had access to focus groups from Borbia. Borbia really good around consumer research. And the focus groups, we put the product into the focus groups, and the focus groups came back and said, great, you're making crisps on your farm. Fantastic, lovely. You're using Irish potatoes, but you're so do Tato. You know, what's different about your product? And really when we got to the essence of what was different about us was that we were a startup business in the depths of a recession in Ireland. And the Irish consumer had this mentality that they were going to support Irish and drive this country out of recession. And that was the communication. We changed our communication. We started to talk about the startup business. We started to talk about the job generation. And my first employees were electricians, carpenters, and brickies, you know, because none of those people had jobs at the time. They were my first employees, and some of them are still with me today. And that really resonated with the Irish consumer. Plus, everything we said was true. And most of my competitors, a lot of food products you buy today, it's all smoke and mirrors. You know, they'll say something and they'll make sure that they're saying it in a way that they cannot be challenged according to the law. For us, we could say anything we wanted to do because everything we said was true. And if a journalist like Roisin Ingle wanted to come and visit a farm and see how it's done, she could ring me. And we had so many of those people around Ireland got to know us through these genuine articles and genuine pieces that talked about our product. Mm.
There's a huge lesson there in terms of the authenticity piece, but also like how you frame your message. It's so important. Mm. People need to be able to understand, what do you do?
Yeah.
Like you're up against Tato. Like, what do you guys do that's different?
That's different,
like,
yeah.
There's so many good lessons there for startups and just how you portray yourself and going forward is so important. Noreen, bring me up kind of to 24, 25, as we are now looking into the year ahead. What's been kind of like your goals now for the next year? What are you looking ahead going, there's big opportunity here? So for any entrepreneurs that are in the audience or listening, like, where do you think there's big opportunities this year?
So for us, we're expanding our business into probably triple the size it is now. We're going to build a purpose-built facility for our lab and our manufacturing and our warehouse, and to have it all underneath one roof. At the moment, we rent four different properties and it's just all scattered. So we have the planning in now for, should be back next month. So that's ideally what we're going to focus on for the next year. And then as well as that, the main focus of the brand is to, I suppose, we haven't branded. We have no branding. I'd say you're like, oh God, how do you even have a business if you don't brand? But
I did try to find you online.
Yeah, you're a ghost. I'm a ghost. I don't exist. So, you know, as Tom was saying, word of mouth is the best recommendation for a business. All of my business comes from word of mouth. All of the brand owners, we have 37 different brand owners. Once or twice or maybe four times a year, they all end up in the same room together, whether it be Image Awards or Gossies or whichever. They're all brand owners, entrepreneurs, and they all end up. And I suppose the people I work with, I have great relationships with them. I've known them for so long that they will scream my name in a room full of opportunities. And I'm very lucky in that way. So we have a targeted plan to take on new brands, but the focus for next year is to bring production Irish production that is being produced in the UK back into Ireland and into the Irish economy. Because I think people years ago, made in Ireland stamp did mean an awful lot. It kind of lulled there for a while and they weren't too bothered because the prices in Ireland were quite high and that, you know, we couldn't do anything about that with interior supply chains. But now the focus is coming back to having, the Made in Irish stamp, Made in Ireland stamp on pack again. So we're working extremely hard with different brands from the UK, especially to, to bring back brands to Ireland to manufacture and that would bring over 1 million units back into the Irish economy, which is which would be a huge accomplishment. And I hope that by 2026, we'd have them back in Ireland.
And then, Tom, you mentioned something earlier about kind of exporting. You've a real danger of being a niche brand in Ireland. You can't really exist. So how do you look at the export market?
In Ireland, we are the only Irish-owned branded manufacturer of potato crisps here. The market is controlled by Intersnack from Germany. They own all the Irish brands that we've known and grown up with. And then you've got Walkers. So we're flying the tricolour in the middle of that. We've about 12-13% market share. And it's very difficult to grow further here in Ireland because of the size of the competitors here. We found blue sky overseas. You know, we found great potential through innovation. We've developed a product for the airline industry that we're the first people in the world to do it. It's a very special sized crisp in a bag that has the pressure equalized for in-flight retail. And, you know, because of that, we are now dealing with actually last year, 300 million people flew aboard planes with Kiehl's crisps on board all over the world from Singapore to the States. And that's been a huge business growth for us, but it's also massive exposure for the brand. You know, we have people all over the world. 300 million people are seeing our product on these planes. And what we have found is that in a lot of countries overseas that Ireland is so marketable. You know, we are seen as this amazing green jewel of an island on the edge of the Atlantic Ocean that produces the nicest food in a sustainable way that's safe and reliable. And when you go to, you know, market products from this country overseas, I think we are always at a competitive advantage straight away just because who we are. And you will find in countries all over the world, we have traveled very well as a people for generations. And generally speaking, somebody from Ireland has done something really good where you are trying to sell your product, and there's respect for that. And that has helped us greatly in establishing markets in the 20 countries we deal with today.
You mentioned something there about sustainability and kind of like the green aspect of things. How have you kind of adopted kind of sustainability practices within the farm? Because I think nowadays, like, people just won't deal with you if you're not sustainable, or is that true?
No, it's not true. Sustainability, we are very lucky in sustainability in that we deal literally with the soil right through to the shelf. You know, we cover the entire supply chain. So we have so much to do around sustainability, and I do feel we have a huge responsibility to act on that. What I'm finding with sustainability is that it is an extremely difficult minefield for a consumer to navigate. And that is because it hasn't been legislated correctly yet. So you could walk into the local supermarket here, you'll probably pick up 20 food brands with claims stating, I've done this, you do that, I've no carbon, you've this, I'm this. And the reality is, in the background, there's nobody policing that. There's nobody policing these claims. And it's an awful shame because that could be a competitive advantage for businesses and force them to do a lot more around sustainability. But the minefield of communication around it has resulted, I think, in a lot of companies pulling back. Now, access to finance is starting to change that. You know, if you want to go to the bank, you get money to build a factory, you now need to show that bank how sustainable that factory is going to be. And that will then allow you access better funding. But at the moment, it is a minefield. But the future, you know, there is no future without sustainability. Eco is being put back into economy.
We're going to come to questions in a couple of minutes. So if you have questions for Tom and Noreen, we'll come to you very shortly. Noreen, then the same question to you. How has sustainability played a part in the growth of advanced cosmetics?
So all of our materials have to be either partially or fully sustainable. So they come in as mass balance if they're partially. When we're building our brand new facility, we will be working with Lean to ensure that everything is sustainable. There'll be solar panels. We also have a patent pending manufacturing process whereby we reuse, it's recycling the heat from the tanks to heat the building and things like that. But from a product perspective, when we're sourcing the componentry, it's very important that it's recyclable for us, even the packaging that it comes in, that we manage that correctly and that everything is recycled in compliance. And then that the customer is made aware of how they can recycle, if they can recycle. You know, it's all physically on pack that is regulated. And, you know, the majority of our clients are RayPack registered, which means that they are fully compliant to the recycling of it. We also have, of late, a lot of refill packs. So you buy the full pack and then it's called a parent pack, and then you can you can just buy the refill and you pop it in and it's more sustainable. You're using less plastic. Then we're getting rid of a lot of unit cartons, which means that it's less bulky. And that lends to even for transport. You know, it's less bulky, there's less transport over and back of those materials as well. So yeah, it's very important for us to include that, especially when we're building our new facility, that everything is done sustainably.
Enterprise Ireland helps to support and fund a vibrant startup ecosystem, providing supports, insights, and network connections to the most ambitious Irish startups. From expert advice to raising funding, exploring opportunities in international markets, to strategic planning, Enterprise Ireland is here to support you in those important startup moments. For more information about how Enterprise Ireland can support you on your startup journey, visit enterprise-ireland.com. Enterprise Ireland, helping Irish startups go global.
I'm going to come to you both for kind of advice for early stage and aspiring founders now shortly. Before that, do we have any questions from the audience for Tom or Noreen? Yourself here?
Noreen, how do you export your products from Ballina? Is it via rail or road?
So all of the products are picked up by courier or by hauliers, and they're distributed to the different distribution centres that is managed by our clients. So one would be TBM Solutions, they would be our auto-fulfill, and then they are distributed by those distribution centres. And then past that, they are taken by air to the US. If they are, we'll say, it needs to get there quickly, we go by air. It can go by sea as well.
Yourself?
One for Tom. I've recently started a bolt-on company, which is obviously in the snap game. How do I navigate making an impact in Ireland and also just the food and health regulations in Ireland dealing with raw meat?
Bolt-on. Nice. So the reality is that in my experience, Irish consumers do not buy meat snacks. It's a very, very small market here. So your opportunities are overseas. Yeah. And even the UK market is much more open to a meat-based snack than the Irish market. In relation to the export of meat-based products, it can be difficult. And obviously, you're limited in certain markets, Middle East being one, and obviously the USA. And we've encountered situations whereby going into the USA, even if the product does not contain meat, but it might say something like a turkey or a steak on the product, the customs will still put it in. So it is difficult. And my advice would be, don't take any chances. Because if when you do actually come up against customs, I had a $50,000 bill one day from customs in New Jersey. Now, I didn't pay it, but they tried it. Yeah. Does that help?
Yeah, maybe a follow-up.
Go ahead. Yeah.
So I'm actually targeting the Irish market because in South Africa, everyone wears Biltong. Mm. I am finding I'm getting a lot of positive feedback. So I'm crafting my campaigns to sort of go after the Irish market. What sort of messaging can I help sort of break the stigma around meat, if you have any points on that?
I think what you need to do is get people to try your product. If it's as good as you say it is, the only way to get them to change their habit is to get them to try it. Yeah. And in the early days, that's what if I had an opportunity to sample and mass sample, I remember giving out Shamrock Crisps at the St. Patrick's Day Parade in Dublin. And I wasn't allowed to, but I did it anyway. And just, 20,000 bags of crisps around the parade. But just to try to get people to taste your product. And if your product has that point of difference and you feel like the feedback you've got warrants the opportunity to do that, that's what I would do. Get them to taste it and get them to try change their habits. Because that's food is like that. You need to, again, it's the flywheel in food. Yeah, get a few early adopters and then start moving. Thank you.
Yes.
No, wait, how have you dealt with the, I suppose, all the regulations around cosmetics? You know, like the, for example, with the fig tan, how all that got recalled then because of the UHT and all this kind of thing. How have you found dealing with all that?
So the regulation is ever-changing. There's always changes to the different annexes, and we just have to keep up to date with it. And we do that through regulatory compliance meetups every 6 months. But I suppose if you were to take the DHA regulation, so the DHA regulation came into force because the only data they had on the DHA was at 10%. Physically, for the body, it's not actually harmful. It's just that the data they had was at 10%. And now that testing on animals is not allowed, we only actually test on humans. So the data is only at 10%. So it's not that it's harmful for your body. It's not that it's harmful or that it's absorbed badly into your body. It just means that that's the data they had. So how we dealt with that was there's usually about 3 years when we get flagged that the regulation is going to be written into regulation. Then the year after, we have to stop formulating to that regulation. And then the year after again, we have to stop manufacturing the product, and then the year after again we have to pull all products from the market. So generally there is no recall of the products. It's usually dealt with the brand actually brings them back themselves, or we produce a new product by the time. So we deal with one of the biggest, I actually formulated for nearly all the self-tan brands in Ireland, so we had to reformulate all the products. They were all up on 16% DHA for the ultra darks, so it was a huge challenge to take away 6% of a product and try and give the colour payoff to be the same. I'm sure everyone, appreciate that. The girls definitely did anyway. So that's what we did. We reformulated it. But in doing that, it became a more interesting product again, because there was a point when we just kept adding more DHA to it and the tans became darker. It challenged us to add different materials, and it challenged us to make it more skin friendly. And so we came up with a solution of two or three different materials along with DHA at around 10% in order to give that payoff. But it was great for the skin because it was more kind on the skin as well. And I think we got the colour payoff right in the ultra darks, but maybe you can tell me.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I'm sorry, do you find it easy to, I suppose, working with lots of different brands? They all have their USPs and what they want to sell in their products, but do you find it easy to kind of give them, I suppose, different products, even though it's the same, or different formulations, even though it's the same product?
Yeah, so each and every brand owner is very different in what they want, in the way they want to sell their product, in the way that they want the product to work in the sensorial products, parts of the product as well. So having a relationship, as I was saying earlier, with the brand owner is very important, and knowing their likes and, more importantly, their dislikes is very important too. So each and every product we develop is developed in line with what the customer wants. We might come up with an idea and they'd say, well, I think we should do it this way, or maybe we should do another one this way, and we might come up with two different products. But every entrepreneur is different. Every single person who develops a product or an idea or a business, they're going to do it in their own way. And it's the same thing when it comes to product development. We do it for a specific brand or USPs. But yeah, we're always trying to innovate, and we've key people in supply chain in order to be ahead. Now we're developing products for 2026 and we're manufacturing for Christmas already. So we have to be ahead of the trends. So that's how kind of we do it. Yeah.
Okay, we'll take yourself and then yourself.
All right, Tom, you were talking a lot about how your messaging is the truth when you're talking about the brand and how that sets you apart. How do you make sure that that actually happens, that what you're saying is what you're doing? Because you're referencing a lot of other brands as well who are just putting something on their packaging and it's not really what is in there. So how do you make sure that that kind of synergy continues to happen as the business grows and the brand evolves?
Just keep telling the truth. That's it. Yeah. And don't, you know, don't, I suppose, realize you don't need to go outside of that to get a sale or to make a claim. Just be comfortable in your own shoes. Yeah, and eventually it'll start to work. Yeah. Thank you.
Hi. You touched on the mass sampling, but I feel like as a small business owner who now has like my own product line and stuff, I'm always in two minds between, like, I want everyone to try the product, but I also don't have the funds to be able to give everything for free.
Mm.
And I want to know kind of like, where's the point where you kind of, you know, you've done the kind of supplying and kind of letting people sample it, but now I'm like, right, okay, now I need to stop and kind of start the kind of sales point of view again. Where is that kind of divide, or when do I make my mind up about that?
Well, I suppose you need to cut your cloth to suit. So, you know, obviously there's a sampling campaign that suits your scale, and just be comfortable with that. By all, the most important thing, just make sure you're hitting the right people, because there's so many people will go out, like, you see the big food and drink brands, and, you know, they'll just stop a street and give them all a free can. That's not going to work for you. You know, you need to be extremely targeted. You need to know exactly who your customer is, where they are, and make sure you're getting them to try your product, and keep doing that. And as your brand grows and your product range grows, just widen that out. But it is a very, very effective way of getting people to buy your product again. And when they do try your product, make sure you give them a way to buy that product, be that a voucher or an e-com address, whatever it is. But yeah, like, just make sure there is a buyback option on it.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, do one more.
I was wondering, seeing that you work with so many brands, how does the intellectual property work of each blend of products you make for everyone? Do you own it, or is it in the contract that they can take to another manufacturer? A little bit about that would be great. Thank you.
So once we develop and test the product and we release it to the brand owns the full IP and formula of that product. So yeah, they can go to any manufacturer in the world. Now, obviously, we prefer it was us, but I think I structured the business that way because I prefer someone to want to work with us than to have to make them work with us. And because eventually, you know, they'll go out of contract with us if they really want to. So, the IP belongs to the brand.
That makes sense. This is the last one.
Yeah. just as someone who's in the lash industry, I'm kind of targeted towards, obviously, lash techs and stuff. So just for yourself, have you ever thought about getting into the lash industry and kind of that kind of route of things? Because I feel like it's became such a big thing. Obviously, we're dealing with a lot of overseas, so like Korea, Singapore, and, you know, I feel like that's the communication can be quite hard. So I'd just be interested, have you ever thought of that?
So we can only manufacture what are called wet cosmetics. So we wouldn't be into any sort of... would say eyelashes. It's not that we're not into it, we don't have the facilities to make it. However, if I was to give you advice about sourcing from China or Korea, I would advise you to go there. There are people as well who give you advice on good suppliers. I mean, I can put you in contact with someone who has bought quite a lot of lashes. So, it would be an idea to go over there and just be on the ground with the staff, and then they can put a face to the name of the person who's ringing them, annoying them all the time about lashes. Exactly. Yeah, you'll meet people there. So
it's like perfect because it's obviously only in Italy and they're from Korea, so it's.
Yeah, exactly. Really, and that's a great meeting point for people because that's where all of our clients would go. Yeah, exactly. And just when you're bringing in product from China or Korea, just make sure you check the compliance of it. Everything is usually fine, but just doubly check that the compliance is fine with it when you're bringing it in.
Thank you so much. I'm sure that the guys will hang around for another couple of questions after it, but I'm going to, conscious of people's time, we're going to wrap it right here. Can you please thank, first of all, the local enterprise offices putting this together. I'll remind you again, the local enterprise week is from the 3rd to the 7th of March this year. There'll be tons of events just like this happening, so do go check them out. And then big round of applause to Tom and Noreen for an incredible hour.
Thank you very much.